So as we've been finding our way into this beautiful text called the Discourse on Loving Kindness, we've come through teachings on the foundations of the path, qualities to cultivate, ethics, and we've crested into the difficulty of cultivating this quality of a wide open heart toward everyone, everywhere, including difficult people. And we spent a couple weeks talking about difficult people and karma and cause and effect and what it is to wish well for folks who have done harm. And where we've come to now in the text is this paragraph that describes in a way the actual practice. And so I want to talk tonight about the technical or meditative practice of metta. And it says, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. So this is a version of a very standard kind of a stock paragraph in the text. So I actually brought one of the discourses that has it in it. And I'm going to read you this standard phrase. So this is from the suttas, or discourses, that are part of the Pali canon. Pali is the language that the earliest layer we have a record of Buddhist discourses is written down in. It's called a Prakrit, or a variant of Sanskrit. And it's the body of texts used now by folks in what's called the Theravada tradition, which is which means the way of the elders, and it's the earliest layer of Buddhist lineage that's still around, and it's practiced mostly now in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, a bit Burma, and then now in many traditions in the West, including Vipassana and insight meditation traditions. So we're blessed to have beautiful new translations into English of almost the entire Pali canon now, which really is a radical thing. It puts this vast body of incredible teachings into easy reach in the English-speaking world. And this is not just radical for us, but it's actually radical in the history of Buddhism, that for the entire history of the religion up till now, the texts have been readable only essentially by literate monastics, which were a very, very small portion of the congregation, and a printed volume of the entire canon might only, you know, a monastery might have one copy, and that might be the only copy for hundreds of miles around. And so monks, not even all monks would read it, of course, and monks are nuns, and many of them would only teach the bits that they memorized in school or that were taught to them, and excerpts, in a way. And only in the last 20 years has this radically changed due to printing, and of course now due to the internet. You can now go to a website that has the entire canon in multiple languages available to you. Or you can spend, you know, a few hundred dollars, but on chunky books like this one, and have the entire canon on your bookshelf, which is just incredible. So it's been amazing for me to, pivotal for me to be able to read these texts in this way. So here is the traditional phrasing for this practice of loving kindness. A practitioner abides, and abides means in a certain way stays or rests but abides meditatively, like stabilizes the attention or the mind in one place. A practitioner abides, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he abides, pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. So that's the stock phrase. It gets repeated over and over through the canon. We can do a couple things with it. First of all, we can make it gender neutral. Even originally, it applied both to monks and nuns. But most texts in a patriarchal tradition, it's phrased in the masculine gender. And then it frames this pervading, I like the translation pervading, pervades one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. So that quarter refers to the compass directions. And we've been doing a bit of this practice, like radiate to the west, radiate to the south, radiate. And then sometimes we'll practice it in context of the body, radiate from the front of the body, radiate from the side of the body. And so it describes one quarter, the second, the third, and the fourth. That's the four compass directions. So above, below, and then just around and everywhere. So the sense that the practitioner is imagining him or herself as the center point of a sphere that goes out in all directions and then pervades that sphere, it says, with a mind imbued with loving kindness. So there's a couple things that happen here. One is the practice of imbuing the mind with loving kindness. So in practice, we do this by bringing up thoughts of goodwill, thoughts of kindness, wishing well. And in whatever way we can, generate the feeling of loving kindness. And here we can also remember that when it says mind, it means mind and heart. They're not separate in the early texts. So mind here really means the subtle sensing factors that are not the five physical senses that I think of as mine. So thoughts and feelings, essentially, ideas, concepts, energy, all comes can come under this umbrella mind. So imbues the mind with loving kindness. Loving kindness as a quality, then it's an emotional quality, and emotional qualities, they color the mind, right? When you're sad, you see everything through the lens of sadness. When you're joyful, you see everything through the lens of joy. So here it says, make loving kindness your lens. And then, this is an interesting phrasing, pervades that quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. So often I think when we do radiating metta practice, and I'll talk about that practice in a second, I feel this myself, I kind of feel like I'm sending the quality out, like there's a searchlight coming out of my heart, and it's, you know, blasting everybody over there. I got you. I blasted you with loving kindness. And it feels directional. But and the word radiate that we get in some of the texts does feel directional in a soft sort of way, like light radiates. It doesn't say, like, shoot out, you know. But pervade is different, and pervade is interesting. It feels less directional. Pervades that quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And the phrasing there is also interesting. It's like I take this mind that has the quality of loving kindness, and I make that mind as big as the entire universe in that direction. So I pervade that quarter of my experience with the mind. And it's just, it's subtle and interesting to think about being told not to send something outward, but in a sense to expand your own mind to encompass that much. And then when your mind encompasses that much, imbued with this quality, it in a sense amplifies the quality to that degree. That much more loving kindness. So then the practice is to assemble, right? Why would it list all of the quarters if it just said everywhere, if that was enough? But it feels like it's a little cumulative, right? I take it a chunk at a time, like this piece of the pie, the mind, loving kindness, and this piece, and this piece, and this piece, and this, and this, and then the sense of everywhere. So, in practice, one of the ways this is practiced, and the teacher that's most known for this right now is a young German monk translator who's a monastic in a Sri Lankan lineage, and he's one of the most interesting and precise translators and historians right now in the tradition. His name is Venerable Anallio. If you get a chance to study with him, to drop everything and go, is my humble suggestion. But particularly because he's a bit of a grump around technology, and he won't let anything be recorded. He's like, recordings don't do it. You want to be in the room. Don't record my talks. Nothing's online. Brr. And I'm like, come on, dude. You know, some of us like live on the other side of the world. Like, be kind. But he's a little austere on the recordings front. There's one long talk of his on a website called Dharma Seed that you can look up. Ask me if you want to find it. So he teaches this kind of practice, and it's drawn more directly from this passage, from these passages in the suttas. So, and the way that we've been practicing the radiating metta is inspired by his style of practicing this, which is to not use phrases or images of people, but really based in the sense of the body as being in space and in place. This is a very kind of bringing the body into its place kind of practice, because when you relate to the directions, you put yourself in the world in this particular way. And I like that a lot about this. And then we've been practicing both kind of radiating the sense of well-wishing out in a direction, but also, I think we did this last week or the week before, we used the breath at each side of the body. So like breathing through the whole front of the body and letting the breath and the felt sense of kindness grow in that direction. And then through the right side of the body and just growing in that direction. So using the sense of the body to awaken us to the directions in that way. I just finished teaching this, co-teaching with my partner, a six-week series up at Spirit Rock in Marin, Mindfulness for Teenagers. We had 22 teens between the ages of 14 and 17, which is always just a wild scene to sort of, and I've done it a few times now, kind of been with those groups, and it's lovely. There's always just hella trauma in the room. They're wounded. And it's also just like bright and brilliant and funny and a little unrestrained in the way no problem, guys, but like we're a little restrained here, right? You know, but the teenagers, they're just like, they're teenagers. It's so good. So we were on day six of our 6 week series, the last class, and we have a little day long, or half day long, and we took them out for a walk, a silent walk on the land, and we did a standing meditation out, kind of in the rolling hills, on the Spirit Rock land, and we did a meditation that did this directions thing, and we said, okay, so you know, first just look around, and now everyone face this way, and I was like, that's west, you know, and a lot of them are from there, but like, to take a moment and really do this, and it's a beautiful practice, do it sometime. That's west, and look at it and be like, there's just a few miles of rolling hills between us and the ocean. You could walk there one long day at the water. There's the ocean. And the entirety of all the rest of America, everything of America that's not Olema and Point Reyes Station is behind you, right? So all of those states, all of that politics, all of your families, unless you live over there, is all back there. And like, get that. Where you are, and then zoom out and be like, California, North America, the hemisphere, the planet, like, here's where you are. And we did that for each of the directions. Imagine we turned north, and it's like, up there is Oregon and Canada and, you know, polar bears and all of that is that way. And we did some of this practice of just, like, wish well to everything that way. And after we did this, we did it in all the directions. We didn't do up and down because I wanted them to stay more grounded than that. Up gets really trippy. Down is really good. It's grounding, but it's also a little more abstract. But the four directions are awesome. And afterward, I was like, what's it like? And they really liked it. And they all said things like, oh, it was really like, you know, it's just like calming and grounding and stabilizing. And you know, and one of them said, like, I live here, but I never really thought about where I am. Mm. And it's like, yeah, exactly, right? And how many of us don't? So this practice both cultivates this mind of loving kindness, but it also kind of situates us in place. You have to know where you are on the planet to do this. So this is one style of formal metta practice. It's really simple. It doesn't have a lot of complexity to it. And it's mostly about cultivating the feeling and then feeling that feeling or breathing that feeling or pervading, just use the old word, pervading that feeling out in all directions. And one more really nice method for doing this is to link this with what's sometimes called the full body breath. And when I do this practice, we've done it here some. Rather than thinking about the breath at the nose or the chest or the belly, I imagine that as I'm breathing in, I start by imagining it, pretty soon I can feel it, but that the breath comes in through the skin on all sides in towards center and releases outward in all directions through the skin on all sides. And this is nice. It gets trippy quickly, which is nice. Inhaling to center and exhaling out. And so you can do this. We've done this a bit with metta, where you just inhale all of your resources, all of the goodness, your sincerity in practice, the connection with others, all of the good things that support you in practice. And then as you exhale with no force, but just pervading, you let your kindness, your compassion, your sincere wish for well-being just shine out from your body as a kind of soft light. Or like the body is a bell and you draw in the breath, ringing the bell, and breathing out, the bell just rings and the sound travels in all directions. So this is a lovely way to practice. So I'll read the traditional phrase one more time. She abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to herself, she abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. Abundant, right? No scarcity. Exalted, immeasurable. In the commentaries say that those two words, exalted and immeasurable, refer specifically to the deep states of meditative concentration called jhana that this practice can lead to. So I want to speak to that aspect of this a little bit. We think of metta often as a heart-opening practice or a practice that heals relationship with ourselves and others, that generates this feeling of love, unconditional love, and all of that's true. It is also one of the most conducive or easy to cultivate methods for meditative concentration or samadhi in the early system. The folks that I know who practice deep meditative stabilization called jhana or absorption, meditation states where the mind is incredibly stabilized, very, very focused, very energized, profoundly calm, not distracted even a little bit. Those states are challenging to get into, but not impossible at all. And many of the people that I know, I would probably say most of the people that I know that practice them and that are good at them, use metta as the doorway in. And most of the others use breath. And you could use either. But because loving kindness is so compelling for many of us, and it draws us in, and it's delicious and beautiful, and sometimes even kind of sensual or it's loving, right? That those qualities themselves, because we like them, make it easier to stay with, and anything that's easy to stay with is supportive of then of concentration, since the main thing that supports concentration or meditative stability is not force of will, but is continuity over time. So it's not about how deeply you can concentrate for a few moments, but about how long you can maintain a gentle stability. Yeah. So then doing this thing that's quite sweet, really, builds up concentration in an easy and delicious way. So it's both heart-healing and conducive to stability in the mind. So here's a second style, then, of practicing this. And this is the first one that I learned. It's perhaps the most commonly one taught in the States, at least in the Insight Meditation tradition, because it was taught in the States by the tradition that was one of the two root traditions of Insight Meditation here, which was a Burmese Vipassana method coming from a teacher named Mahasi Sayadaw, and particularly his student, Upandita. And I studied this with my teachers at Spirit Rock, Jack and Sylvia, most particularly, but also with my teacher in Burma when I was a monk there, who was a brother monk to Upandita. His name was Ujjanika. And this is a practice not taken from the original suttas, but from the commentaries that were written down several hundred years later. And so the text I'm going to read to you from is called the Visuddhimagga, or the Path of Purification. And this is the primary commentary on the early Buddhist meditative practice. It's pretty dry, but you know, useful when you need to look something up. And so one of the things that happened in the commentaries is that the practices of deep meditative stabilization, jhana or samadhi, were very formalized, and they were, and they became more technical in certain ways. And one of the ways is that this practice of radiating metta started to be associated with a practice of, how do you radiate it to all the directions? You might do it by thinking of different categories of beings, you know, young beings, old beings, like the sutta says, medium, short, and small, seen and unseen. And so here's some different language in this text on how this practice should be developed. And how does a bhikkhu, meaning a practitioner, dwell pervading one direction with his heart filled with loving kindness? So, like most commentaries, right, it starts with a line from the text. So that's a line from that first phrase, right? Abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. So then the commentary says, how does one do that? And here's its answer. Just as he would feel loving kindness on seeing a dearly loved person, so he pervades all beings with loving kindness. So there's a first step. It says, well, if you want to know how to feel love, think about someone you really love. That's the feeling. Now, pervade it to everyone, right? So that's the first step of this kind of increased complexity. You bring in an image of someone, the dearly loved person, and then one of my teachers called this the bait and switch, where you're like you think of the person you really love, and you're like, oh, I love them. I love them so much. Oh, they're so good. I feel so warm toward them. And then all beings, I love them too. And the feeling kind of still is burning a little bit. And you're just like, yeah, you too. And you just kind of see, if you're concentrated enough, you can just make that switch. And, you know, you slide the personal love out of the way, and you just bring in the impersonal, and you keep the feeling going. And as you're practicing this, one instruction would be, if the feeling really fades, bring the personal person back in, right? Like, you can really improvise with this. It's not about, however, loving your personal people more. It's about loving your personal people as a way to really understand what it feels like to love big, and then opening it out to all beings. So just as she would feel loving kindness on seeing a dearly loved person, so she pervades all beings with loving kindness. And then it goes on. In what five ways is the mind deliverance of loving kindness practiced with unspecified pervasion? That's the kind of language that it's like, really, that's just a little. In what five ways is the mind deliverance of loving kindness practiced with unspecified pervasion? May all beings be free from enmity, affliction, and anxiety, and live happily. So, here's the beginning of the phrases practice. And it came down to us as this practice of repeating four phrases that a very traditional sequence is safe, happy, strong, and at ease. Those are the ones that I use. Or safe and protected, strong in body, strong in mind, peaceful and well-being, that kind of thing. You can change them around. This one says free from enmity, or which is like anger or hatred, affliction and anxiety, and live happily. So you could say each of those is a phrase. May all beings be free from danger. May all beings be free from affliction. May all beings be free from anxiety. May all beings live happily. And then it starts into what we could call categories. May all breathing things, and then it has a dot, 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 be free from enmity, affliction, anxiety, and live happily. May all who are born, all persons, all those who have a personality, be free from enmity, affliction, and anxiety, and live happily. So we have here the beginnings of a formal practice of cultivating the feeling through repeating these phrases of well-wishing, and then directing them to different categories of beings. And this first set of categories is all breathing things, all who are born, all persons. So now we've got, if we include under breathing things, all of the plants, and then all who are born includes the animals, of course, all persons, and then all those who have a personality. And one might quibble between like persons and beings with a personality. Why are those different? Just leave that one uncommented on. Be free, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes on saying, it says, how do you send this wish to all beings? And it says, well, you should reflect on the way that your wish for happiness and other beings' wish for happiness are the same thing. And it says, I am happy just as I want to be happy and dread pain, as I want to live and not to die, so do other beings too. Making himself the example, then desire for other beings, welfare and happiness arises in him. So he should first, as example, pervade himself with loving kindness. Next, after that, in order to proceed easily, he can recollect such gifts, kind words, etc., as inspire love and endearment, such as virtue, learning, etc., as inspire respect and reverence met within a teacher or his preceptor, develop loving kindness toward him, etc. So, and then it proceeds to develop into this sequence that has become standard. So now I'll tell you roughly the modern kind of standard sequence. The sequence as taught by our Asian teachers was to start with yourself and then go to your teacher or benefactor and then a dear friend or someone who you love easily in a personal way, and then to a neutral person, and then to a difficult person, and then to categories of all beings. And there's a couple different formal lists of categories that that include things like beings who are born, you know, animals. The list that I did separated them into like beings who fly, beings on the ground, beings under the ground or under the water, people, old people, young people, etc. And the full sequence would be, again, starting with yourself, benefactor, friend, neutral person, difficult person, and then each of those categories, all the way down a whole list of categories, and you would do that entire thing in a direction. And when I did it, my teacher divided it into 8 directions rather than 4, so I had to do the whole sequence, all of the categories of beings, to the north, and then turn an eighth of a turn and do the entire sequence to all the beings in the north by northeast. And then another quarter turn, all beings to the northeast, and then all beings, etc. That would be 16. North, northeast, east, etc. 8 was the, and then up and down. So, and for each of those, you're doing all 4 of your phrases, right? And visualizing the category. I got to that point of complexity at about the 6-week mark, doing a 2-month retreat, doing only this practice. So the formal sequence was like, do only yourself for 2 weeks, and that's all day, every day. Don't let the phrases stop for even a moment. From the moment you wake up, you start the phrases. And all the way through, anything you're doing, through the meals, through the breaks, you just keep the phrases going. There's a little hump to get over in the very beginning, and then it's just kind of sweet. Like, I spent weeks and weeks wandering around this nice place, just going, may I be peaceful? May I be happy? May I be at ease? So you do yourself for as long as needed, really. And so at one point, I was having a really bad time. My teacher said, like, maybe you should do metta for yourself for a year. Don't do anyone else for the entire year. And I'm like, you're probably right. I didn't do it, but that was the instruction. And then after you do yourself, you would shift to, you know, bringing in the benefactor, the neutral person, the difficult person. We've talked about each of these in different ways. And then once you go into the all beings sequence, you can let go of the earlier ones and just do all the categories of all beings in the directions. But it took me several weeks to get there. By the time I got there, I was standing outside. This was a spring retreat. I was told to do it outside so I could see the directions. And it would take about 3 hours to get through all the directions. Like all the categories to the north, all the categories to the north. And it was just like this long standing, radiating, remembering all the things. And one of the interesting things about this practice is that when we think of samadhi practices or concentration practices, we often think of really simple practices. Stay with just the breath. Stay with just the mantra. Like these things where it's single-pointed, just one thing. But the metta practice is hella complicated. You have to remember where you are in this long sequence. You have to keep the visual image and the verbal phrases and a connection to the feeling in your own body all going all at the same time. And it turns out that tracking a complicated thing builds up concentration just as well and better for some people than tracking a simple thing. Just trying to stay with your breath, you know, it's fairly repetitive. It's like, okay, that's a little boring. Stay with this. It's actually quite difficult. But the difficulty is colored by it being super yummy, right? You wander around, you're just like, may everybody be at peace. May everybody, all day, every day, for days on end. One of my teachers did a month of metta at one point, and he said that afterward he went looking back in his journals to see like what was that even like. He had taken some simple notes, and he said at one point several weeks in he had just written on sort of one of the days he had just written one sentence, one fragment, which was heart like melted butter. And I heard that and I was like, I want that. I want a heart like melted butter. So that is then this kind of other form of the practice. These two methods, one with the phrases, one with the radiating, both of them, in addition to working the heart, and of course, as we've talked about before, the emotional part of the practice is both cultivating the beautiful qualities like of love, but is also a purification, meaning when you say, may I feel loving, you know, odds are at some point you won't, right? And you'll be like, oh, actually, I hate everything. And that's the practice, is, you know, and especially when you're working with yourself, for many of us. The Asian teacher said, start with yourself, it's the easiest, and then go on to others. In the West, we had to switch it, because nobody found working with themselves easy. So wounded around self-image. And nowadays, we'll be like, and starting with the benefactor or teacher, really abstract, who has a teacher they completely trust and love without reservation? Yeah, right? So a lot of folks here will start with the close friend, because like those are the people we can actually connect with loving, you know, and then bring in like a public figure you can love easily without reservation, you know. Find one, but that's the idea. This is coming from a tradition that both venerated its elders and found loving oneself actually pretty easy. So, yeah, good for y'all. With having that experience, that is excellent, and I aspire toward it. So start with whatever's easy, basically, and then work your way through the sequence. And so it's both a heart practice and a heart-opening practice and a purification practice. You're practicing along, may I be at peace, may you be at peace, may you be at peace, and you're like, oh, I'm so mad. And the practice is just to to be mad, and be like, yeah, I'm so mad, may you be at peace, may I be at peace, but I'm so mad, may I be at peace. And you just keep the phrases going, and it's okay to be mad, and you just let it burn through, and it moves through. And I've done metta and been miserable, and I've been angry, I've been afraid. And waves of this come through as you, in a sense, polish the heart. And the process of doing so then also builds concentration and is a doorway for entering the deep states known as jhana or samadhi. So radiate in all directions. All right, so any thoughts? Questions about your own practice, about metta practice specifically, or any of this? Yeah.
I just wonder how important, well, I'm curious about the phrases and the feeling.
Yeah. Right. There's the feeling and there's the phrases. This is true for me as well in practice. When the feeling feels like it's really full and there's some concentration, often I want to let the phrases go. You can, of course. One of the things about metta is you can improvise it. The sign that it's going in the direction of healing in a certain way is that the feeling feels like it's doing that. Like in a certain way, the feeling becomes the center for a kind of healing or heart-opening side of the practice. And so then, yeah, let go of the phrases, just rest in the kindness, it's beautiful. If you want to develop concentration on it, you could still do that, but you might want to notice, you will want to notice, if the mind gets a little shaky, because a feeling is very hard to meditate on. They're so fleeting, you know. It's like a wisp of aroma passing through, really. Which is why, to keep the feeling strong enough to be the centerpiece of a meditation, you have to keep churning it. You have to keep kind of cranking it in many cases. So I would often, if I wanted to let the phrases go, sometimes I would do that, but if I would generally need to keep them going or else I would get distracted. I would lose it. So at times I would simplify the phrases down to one word. So it was really like, it was mostly feeling, and I would just be thinking very softly just the word safe, and then just see how it rings in my body, like, oh, what is it? It's safe. Happy. Strong. Ease. And that's all I would do, you know. So lots of space, but still this little, like, both ringing of the feeling and a, like, stay here, stay here, stay here. Yeah. Once absorption is, once you're in jhana, like in the absorption, then the phrases go. But you don't have to decide that. That'll happen on its own. Those are dramatic states when they come on. So. Yeah, it's a good question.
When are those sort of general times that you, a teacher might recommend, or you might recommend doing a metta practice or having a focus on that?
Anytime. some folks do it when they're having, like, kind of emotional or psychological challenge. Just like, it can be much more than the abstraction of, like, breath meditation or wide open space meditation. Metta can be really like an anchor in the storm. You know, lots of emotions, and you can just be like, you know, it's a way of saying, like, may I be safe is like, like, it means what it says, like, may I find safety. It's, I know a lot of folks who cling to this practice, I mean that in a good way now.
Oh.
You know, it really as like, this is their bedrock. And I know of folks who do only this practice for decades. And so anytime. And it's sometimes used to also help to settle the mind and the heart for someone who's really having just a difficult time with basic meditation instructions. If there's lots of restlessness or sleepiness, this might be assigned also. But outside of those cases, for someone who's not in emotional challenge or kind of energetic challenge, I would almost be like, use whatever object or focus for concentration practice feels best to you. So like, if you really like the silence of just breath practice, then just do that. And you might bring in metta practice when your practice starts to feel a little dry or kind of rote or habit or something. Or metta is thought of as kind of a moistener, as it were. Like, you're getting a little dull, you have a little concentration and a lot of stability, but it's not really bright. You might bring in loving-kindness practice as a way to kind of re-soak up the sponge of the body, bring some sweetness in, would be one direction. The last thing I'll say is, if your practice is solid in lots of ways, but you're not finding, like, a deeper groove toward concentration, it might be that you've chosen a meditative object that is comfortable for you to hang out with, but somehow isn't either maybe precise enough or, for whatever reason, just not completely landing for you enough to really bring you into absorption. And then metta might be a nice doorway for that. And you could really just take it as a mature practitioner, as a pathway into samadhi. So any of those. It can be both healing and kind of deeply kind of concentrating. You could just choose.
Yeah. It's interesting that none of those choices you provided have to do with how you're feeling about other people.
True. True. One way to say it, we could say, it's not about other people. Mm-hmm. It's really only about you. Uh-huh. And so it's about cultivating your own feeling. Of course you could use it if you needed to, you know, like, work on your feeling with another person.
Cure some grumpy introversion.
Cure some grumpy introversion, right? that's true. It's a kind of antidote in that sense, right? And it is the antidote to ill will, right? If you find you have a lot of hatred going on, you might do some loving kindness practice. Or, you know, you might do some just like straight up pure vipassana on hatred. Be like, well, look, this is grumpy. Yep, that's grumpy, all right. Oh, look, it's changing. Like, you would, in a certain way, if you have the mindfulness and kind of stability of heart to do it, I'll tend in general to advise just directly processing the unwholesome or unskillful state rather than applying an antidote of like its opposite, which in a sense is a palliative, but it doesn't get to the underlying issue. It's a little bit of a distraction. It's a good distraction. And like if I'm really suffering with something, yes, loving kindness can kind of bring me out of the pit of it. But if I have the presence of heart to do so, I'd rather apply myself with insight to what's actually going on and see if I can resolve it in the nervous system in that way, rather than using it as an antidote. Yeah, it's a good question. Of course, antidote away as well. Thoughts here?
How would you say in the past that the statistics show that most people don't get to that level of calmness and concentration with their breath that the pig, the monkey, keeps spinning off the concentration for the calm of the mind when they're able to concentrate on the breathing?
Yeah.
And I'm very fortunate to see that there is another venue. So is this one more successful, or is there some statistics on whether this is too demanding? Like they said, Andy said that when you are occupied with verbalizing your state of mind or feelings, it could offset some of the intention that you have for your own mind. But you said you can just say, and I really enjoyed listening to when you said happy, strong, and just feel it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So statistically, is this more popular? I mean, more effective?
It seems like a lot of folks find entering concentration through metta easier than entering concentration through the breath. I can't use the word statistic. It's not like anybody has studied this. This is gossip statistical. But this is, you know, a bunch of us hanging out after the retreat being like, so what'd you do? You know. But it seems like a lot of folks really find that settling the mind and coming to that kind of stability using this practice to be a good doorway, a strong doorway for entering it. Other folks totally, like, get there through the breath. So lots of folks use the breath. These are probably the two main methods or doorways to samadhi in my tradition is breath practice and phrases practice. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of whichever works for you.
What happened to you in your history? Because you used to say that you've been running with your thoughts a lot when you were in your evolution. At what point was it for you sort of equivalent practice to be within phrases? Is it something recent? Is it something that comes with learning? Or?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question, but...
the method you used for the meditation?
Yeah, I was taught the phrases practice when I first started at Spirit Rock in 1999.
1999?
Yeah. It's kind of late. So yeah, I was that was when I started in the Theravada tradition. I had done Zen for several years before that. And the phrases was just the standard method taught. So I did it there. I never liked the phrases method very much. It took me a long time to like it.
takes time.
I always just ignore them. It's the pregnant ladies in the next room. They bump against them. The walls creak.
I was so worried.
I thought you guys were doing something.
I think there were ghosts at the walls.
It's ghosts. There are ghosts, but it's many layers of good people over there. I never really liked the phrases practice. It always felt too noisy and busy to me. But 1 year on the 2 month retreat, I was like, fine, I don't like it, but I'm going to do it because if I'm going to not like it, I need to at least really know what I'm not liking. And, you know, I want to do everything. I was the kind of student who wanted to do everything right. So I want to be a correctly practiced student in this lineage. Therefore, I will do a 2 month retreat on just with the phrases. Mm-hmm. And so I did it. And I didn't feel super lovey. I never feel super lovey. Almost, not never, but like not that often. But I just did it, and I just churned the phrases around, and it was really boring, and I did it, and I did it, and I did it, and I did it. And every once in a while, I'd be like, oh, this is really nice. And then it was boring, boring. I kept doing it. And after about 6 weeks, I was really just, like, over it. I was like, this is really, I'm so tired of saying these phrases. I'm done. And my teachers were like, don't stop. Just keep going. Just, like, keep going through it. One morning I got up in the morning and I was like, and my mind just went, no. And I just went back to breath practice and I was like, oh my God, the breath. And I just, because I hadn't tracked my breath in 6 weeks. I'd just been saying these dumb phrases. But I was 6 weeks in and I hadn't like entered jhana or absorption or anything. I hadn't had any sign that the practice was working at all. I didn't feel loving. I didn't feel concentrated. I was just repeating these phrases endlessly. And so 6 weeks in, I just stopped one morning and I sat with my breath and it was like the quietest morning ever. And then I went to breakfast, and it was quiet. I was like, oh, it's so quiet.
No more phrases.
And then no more phrases. And somewhere in the middle of the morning, 4 hours into being with my breath, I was out doing walking meditation, and without getting into descriptions, it was just one of those moments that sometimes happens. Something shifted. And I was like, oh, I'm more concentrated than I thought. And it turned out that like all of that repetition that had been boring, you know, it had still stabilized the mind stream. And so when I settled into the breath, it's like, oh, it was actually quite stable. It wasn't just quiet because I was not saying the phrases. It was quiet because there wasn't a lot of anything else being said either. And so then I dropped into an aspect, a layer of practice that's not usually available to me. And that was really indicative to me, partly of the power of this practice to concentrate the mind, even when it doesn't feel like it's doing so. So then I was like, oh, that's nice. And then I wondered if I should tell my teachers, because then I would have to admit that I had, you know, gone off on my own. I did. Jack was like, look, you're concentrated, all right? Shut up. And I was like, okay, sorry. I'd been complaining for weeks. I'm like, it's not working. He's like, just keep doing it. So he was finally like, it worked already. Now go back, keep doing it. So, cool. Any other thoughts before we go? Yeah.
I mean, I just keep thinking that you can practice. It just sounds very clinical to me, sitting in a retreat and doing it repeatedly. And then what about just walking down the street? And
of course.
Looking people in the eye and smiling and invoking and loving, or here in this room, I notice sometimes I see how we don't look at each other. You know, and I just
we should. Like, you do. Look at people. Yeah.
I was sending metta to each person. I was like, oh, look at her. I see her, and you know, what's it like to be there?
Yeah.
I hope they're happy.
You can totally, of course.
Free from good health,
please do this.
Health, you know, doing really real people instead of like some.
Please do this. Yeah. I wanted to talk about these two types of formal practice.
Yeah.
And the main distinction would be like of course, make it in a certain way like your lifestyle, just to radiate kindness, like not bad. The thing that the retreat practice can do is that it'll cultivate samadhi in a different way. So really, if you're going for these kind of clarified states of mind, then, you know, then a dramatically reduced stimulus essentially is the retreat structure, and that's what it's good for. But yeah, what you're describing, like, for sure, do that, you know.
I think it may be like I was in this one retreat that I did with Gil.
Yeah.
And I started to see the people. I mean, nobody's looking at each other. Everybody's keeping their little private, quiet, silent retreat. But then I started like, oh, look, there's the fat guy who looks like he's from, you know, Yugoslavia or something. Yeah. And these like images of people. And
finally,
we all talk at the end, and there's this tremendous love and is shared when you finally speak. And you say, oh,
absolutely.
He's not from Yugoslavia. He's from, you know, Chicago or something. You know?
Totally. Yeah.
Both were sort of mixed in, you know?
Yeah, in my tradition, we practice a very secluded kind of, a socially secluded kind of retreat. It's good practice for, you know, kind of not being a creep out in the world, but it can be a little isolating.
So we can do it in a meeting where we're in our board meeting or something. There's 15 of us on board, but you can sort of.
Well, you know, I mean, this is why actually. This is the technical reason why, don't tell anybody, but this is the technical reason why we have a relaxed break in the middle of class, right? It's not just to stretch the legs. It's actually that community is only built through interpersonal contact. Like, we actually have to say hi to each other. And in the early sitting groups, you know, it was very just, like, serious. And everyone was like, we want to actually say hi to each other. So it's important to have that as well. Sweet. Lovely to see everybody. Thanks for being here. Where we go next with this, and I promise only 1 week more. Maybe we'll finish it next week, or if not, certainly the one after. The last two lines of this text do something kind of wild, which is they launch off from this, like, cultivating the heart and samadhi thing, like, right out into, like, full Buddhist emptiness wisdom, like, relinquishing all views and, like, not being reborn. So, like we're going to go, like, straight into the wisdom aspect next time. And it's really amazing that the text starts with, it describes this full path of practice, right, from basic discipline and ethics through this, like, universal radiating of kindness, and then zing into, like, not self, the emptiness of views, and, you know, profound enlightenment and dissolving. So we'll go there next time. You're welcome to keep chant sheets if you don't have one at home for home practice, or bring them back. Take a flyer for Oren's course if you like. Gift economy means that your offerings of your resources support the group so that everyone can come, and they go either in the pretty wooden box or at the front desk. And there's a mailing list by the box if you want to hear from me. So take good care. See you soon.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Thank you.